I'm CJ Peterson, and welcome to The Journey is Real. We talk to real people with real passions who share a real portion of their hearts. Today, my guest is Terry Tucker, and we titled his podcast, The Battle From Within. Thank you for coming on today, Terry.
Thanks, CJ. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
It's going to be fun. We were talking before, having a good time, so I'm sure we'll be able to just chill and sit back and relax. You have probably one of the most diverse and varied backgrounds I have run across, and I've run across a lot of people. So that's pretty hard. That's a pretty high bar to hit. And so can you kind of take us back? Because on The Journey is Real, it's as much about the journey as it is the passion. Kind of take us back and explain that varied past, because they got to hear it to understand it.
Yeah. I sometimes look at that and think, well, you know, one of these days I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up, you know, I mean, because I have had such a diverse background. So I'll start. I am the oldest of three boys. You can't tell this from looking at me or hearing me, but I'm 6'8" tall. Have a brother who's 6'7" that pitched at Notre Dame, and another brother that was 6'6" who was drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers, the National Basketball Association. And then my dad was 6'5". So I always kind of joke that, you know, if you sat behind our family in church growing up, there wasn't a prayer's chance you were going to see anything that was going on.
I'm 5'9", 5'10", depending on when you measure me. And I'm the shortest one in my family. So yeah, I get it.
But, you know, I'm like, my 5'8" mother was the boss. It didn't matter how big or strong we were, whatever mom said, that's kind of the way it went. I went to college at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina on a basketball scholarship, despite having three knee surgeries in high school. And when I graduated, I moved home to find a job. I'm really going to kind of date myself now, but this was long before the internet was available.
Oh, no.
To find a job. You know, and I was all set to make my mark on the world with my newly obtained business administration degree. And I kind of look back on now and say, what a knucklehead I was to think I knew anything about business just because I had a degree. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I was able to find that first job in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I ended up living with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mother care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, I was in the marketing department at Wendy's. From there, I was a hospital administrator. Then I totally shift gears and become a police officer. And I was an undercover narcotics investigator, was also a SWAT team hostage negotiator.
I'm trying to follow this pattern and trying to find out how they're connecting and they're not, but okay, go ahead.
I'll explain why they're not connecting kind of as we go. So got out of law enforcement, started a school security consulting business, coached girls high school basketball when we lived in Texas, became a motivational speaker. Last year became an author, but for the last 9 years, I've kind of considered myself a cancer warrior as I battled against this rare form of melanoma. And then finally, my wife and I have been married for 28 years, and we have one child, a daughter, who's graduated the United States Air Force Academy and is a lieutenant in the new branch of the military, the Space Force.
Nice.
Yeah, very proud of her.
Quite a past. So how, okay, the ADD and OCD portion of me is like, how did those connect? So can you kind of take us on that path?
So my grandfather, I kind of got to go back a generation. My grandfather was a Chicago police officer from 1924 to 1954. So he was a cop in Chicago during Prohibition.
When I was going to say, that's a tough time.
It was. It was a very tough time. And so, you know, he was there during Prohibition. He was during the Great Depression. He was there during, you know, the gangs shooting up the city, Al Capone and all that. And he was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. Wasn't a serious injury. He was shot in the ankle. But my dad always remembered the stories his mom told about the knock on the door of, Mrs. Tucker, please grab your son. Come with us. Your husband's been shot. So when I indicated I wanted to go into law enforcement, my dad was like, absolutely not. You're going to go to college. You're going to major in business. You're going to get out, get a job, get married, have 2.4 kids and live in a little house in the suburbs. And I'm like, that was my dad's passion. Mm-hmm. That wasn't mine. Right. But as I mentioned, he was sick. He was dying of cancer when I graduated from college. So I had two choices. I could kind of kick him in the face and say, sorry, Dad, I'm going to go off and do my own thing. Or I could do what I did. And that's my first two jobs were in business. because that's what my dad wanted me to do. And I didn't want to upset him anymore.
And you gave it a fair shot.
And I did. And I met a lot of good people and I learned a lot, but it just wasn't my passion. I didn't want to do it. And then I got an opportunity to go into law enforcement and I was a 37-year-old rookie policeman, which
kind of like that show, The Rookie, that just
it
came
is,
out.
It is. I mean, I was old to be a rookie cop, but it was just a passion. And, you know, when I talk to young people, especially, I always tell them, you know, if there's something in your heart or something in your soul that you want to do, but it scares you, go ahead and do it. Because at the end of your life, the things that you're going to regret are not going to be the things you did. They're going to be the things that you didn't do. And by then it's going to be too late to go back and do them.
Well, and if your dream isn't big enough to scare you, then it's not big enough.
Exactly.
Yep. So with everything you've been through and, you know, now that you're going through, how did you stay positive through that? Especially like when losing your grandmother and your father at the same time, and you weren't really following your passion at that time. You were kind of basically working to live instead of living to work. Wait, you were living to work instead of working to live. I just said that correctly. Do you know what I'm saying? How did you keep that focus positive through that?
I don't know if I did, to be honest with you. It was definitely the most difficult time in my life. I mean, my dad was my hero. My youngest brother was in high school at the time my dad got sick. My other brother was away at college. So it was hard. I mean, my grandmother and my dad were, you know, in rooms right next to each other, both dying of different forms of cancer. So it was literally, I would get up in the morning. I remember this. I would empty my dad's urinal, take a shower, you know, eat breakfast, go to bed or go to work. And then at noon, I would come home and help my mom get him ready to go to work and then put him in the car, load him up, take him to work, get him into his office, go back to my job, and then just do the reverse of that at 5 o'clock. And that was Monday through Friday. So it didn't leave a lot of time for, you know, a young man who was like, okay, I'd like to have a life. I'd like to
have a wife, a family.
Yeah, exactly. Date, you know, just go out on a date or something like that. And it was so funny because I remember one day I was drying my father's hair and he reached out his hand like he wanted to shake hands with me. I'm like, what the heck? You know, and so I shook hands with him. There was $100 bill in the palm of his hand. Aww. And I remember saying to him, you know what? I threw it right back at him. I'm like, are you serious? You and mom spent your entire life helping my brothers and I. You know, we all have college degrees. We all have master's degrees. I mean, are you kidding? You know, and he was like, well, I want you to have this. And I'm like, no, you're making me feel like a prostitute. You know, like that's exactly how I felt. Like you're paying me to help you. I was furious with him. I said, don't ever do that again. You know, and it was like, I love you. I will do whatever I have to do, including put my life on hold until, you know, there comes a time when it's time for me to move on.
Yeah. And it's tough. We lost my dad in July of 2019 and my mom, he was quick. He was in about a week when he went to hospice. My mother, we lost in just January of 2021. And so she was in hospice and it was rough. It was rough on my sister and they were about 3.5 hours from us. So my brother and sister-in-law and my husband and I would split the week in two. So she was never alone, but it was just continuously for, you know, 2 months. And my sister's life was on hold for a good solid. I mean, she took care of him for 10 years before they passed.
Yeah.
And it's like, now she's just kind of coming out of it and she's got her own place. She's building a house. She's, you know, creating herself over who she is without, you know, my parents, which is unique for her. Not necessarily for my brother or I, because, you know, we've been living separate, but like when you're in it and in the middle of it, it's something completely different because that is your life.
It is. And it's the ugly part of life, you know, and it's a scary part and it's a dark part and you know, all the negative adjectives you could use for it, but it's also a part of life. You know, death is as much a part of life as birth and the part we have in the middle. And people get scared. And yeah. You know, I'm often asked now with my cancer, you know, are you afraid to die? I'm like, well, I don't want to hasten it. Don't get me wrong. But no, I'm really not, because yeah. I felt that I found the purpose I was put on this earth to do, and I lived that purpose. There's an old Native American Blackfoot proverb that goes, when you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a way so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm looking for.
Mine is always the dash. There's the birth date, there's the death date, and the dash. Make the dash count.
Yeah.
And it's like, when you take care of a family member that you're losing, my sister would reach moments, and I say to her, I said, look, we're behind you, we support you, we're here. You call, we come, we run. I said, but this is the thing you're doing. You said, and you said out in the beginning, that you did not want them to be in a retirement home in their older age, which is great, because 2020, they would have been locked in.
Yeah.
And it would have been a nightmare.
Yeah.
But that's what she set out to do. And I said, and that's what you're doing. I said, it sucks right now. I said, but you're doing this out of love. I said, and we're behind you. And so giving them that gift was her mission and her goal, and she did it. And so it's like right now what you're going through, I can't imagine, but you're doing it in kind of a little bit slower turn, I'd imagine, than your mother or your grandmother and your father. So it's like, you don't know where that end is. And so you're taking it and you're running with it, and you are just like plowing. In 2016, I went septic, and I had 50% cardiac failure, 100% kidney, and 100% liver failure. And I took that. Before that point, I had a single book, a trilogy, and a set of five come out. Since then, I've had a set of four books come out. I've started another trilogy. I rewrote that very first book. I have podcast. I'm on another podcast, The Con Hour. I'm a publisher. My sister and I co-own Texas Sisterness Press. And it's like, when you hit that point of like, oh my gosh, this is mortality. You know, you no longer think, you know, I have forever. Then you take it and you run. And it sounds like that's exactly what you did. And that's what you're doing right now, is you are running. You're like, nope, if I've only got this much time, I'm running. You're making that dash count.
Yeah. And I did the same thing. You know, I'd never written a book or published a book. And literally, I had my leg amputated in April of 2020. Mm-hmm. And started chemotherapy for the tumors in my lungs in June of 2020. And during that 3-month period that I was supposed to be, you know, sitting around watching Netflix and healing, I wrote a book, and mm-hmm. I published, you know, I got with a publisher and published a book. So yeah, it's like, I want my life to count. And I think it has, even if I hadn't done that, even if I hadn't, you know, I always, you know, the book is kind of born out of two conversations. And one was with a former player that I coached. And I remember she moved to Colorado, where my wife and I live. And I said to her one day, we were having dinner, I said, I'm really excited that you're living close and I can watch you find and live your purpose. And she got real quiet for a while. And she looked at me and she was like, well, coach, what do you think my purpose is? I said, I have no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I found out I had this, you know, this tumor in my leg and I was going to lose it and all that, I went to the mortuary, I went to the cemetery, I went to the church, and I planned my funeral. And I got some brushback for that. People are like, you know, don't you think that's kind of defeatist? And, you know, I kind of looked at them like, well, last time I checked, I think we're all going to die. I mean, I don't think anybody's
looking at a cure for life. How many people get the opportunity to plan their own funeral, number one? Number two, you're helping your wife.
Well, exactly. That was sort of the final gift I thought I could give my family and mm-hmm. say, you know what, when I die, you make one phone call and it's done. All done. Yeah. But it goes back to, you know, everybody dies, mm-hmm. but not everybody really lives. And if mm-hmm. you really live, dying is not that scary.
Yeah. I mean, even if you didn't write that book, which, by the way, that makes you pretty much immortal now, because that book's always going to be there. That's a part of you that will always be there. That's one of the things I love about publishing books, is that story is always there. But the people that you helped being a police officer, the people that you helped being a negotiator, the people that you helped being a coach. You know, there is so many people that lives that you touch, and you're making that dash count.
Yeah.
And that's the point. So the book that you wrote is called Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. That's a mouthful, but it says a lot. Can you kind of give us a few without, you know, kind of giving away the whole book?
Sure. You know, it's funny because the principles, each principle is a chapter. And when people read the book, there's always one principle that sort of jumps out at them. And it's like, this is one that resonates with me. And the one that I like the most, and probably because I'm as guilty of it as most people, is this one. And it's, most people think with their fears and their insecurities instead of using their minds. And I know I've done that. I've done it a lot. You know, it's like, well, I want to do that. Ooh, you know, what will people say if I fail? You know, who cares what people will say if you fail?
Yep.
You know, if you fail and don't learn something, then you're an idiot. If you fail and learn something, then it's been a great experience. I mean, one of the chapters is about failing and failing often, especially when you're young. You know, take that chance, go out there, see what happens, make mistakes when you're young, because, you know, who cares? Yeah, I started something, it didn't work out. You can move on to something else. One of the
you can look at it, learn from it, and figure out a more intelligent way to try to hit it again.
Absolutely.
If that's your passion, don't let one thing stop you.
No, absolutely not.
Try it again and hit it again. And it may take a couple times. Successful people are only somebody who's failed so many times that they finally got it right.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, nobody's an overnight success. I mean, it just doesn't
happen.
If they
do, they're going to be an overnight under success too. So
yeah, exactly. But one of the other chapters that I really like, and I learned this when I was a negotiator. You know, as a policeman, most of your job is face to face with people, whether, you know, you're giving them a traffic ticket or you're responding on a run from the radio that you need to investigate. And you can see things. You know, if people are balling up their fists, maybe they're going to fight you. Or if they're kind of looking around, maybe they're looking to escape or run. And you can do, you know what? I can sit you down. I can handcuff you. I can put you in the back of the car. I can do whatever is appropriate for why I'm there. But as a negotiator, we were not face to face with that person. So we had to figure things out based on what people were saying, what they weren't saying, and how they were saying it. And I think the most important part of that whole chapter is the idea of listening to understand as opposed to listening to respond. And I know I'm guilty of this.
Yes. No, yeah. Yes.
I mean,
thank
I'm
you.
So guilty of this. It's like, you know, all right, CJ, hurry up and say something because I want to get my 2 cents in. No. Why is CJ saying what CJ's saying? Understand what she's saying and why she's saying it. Mm-hmm. And if we could do that as a society, as a country, as a world, my God, we could do anything.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That is like, that's one of my pet peeves, actually, when people do that. There's some people that I counsel. And so there's a couple of them where I call them all the time. I'm like, don't listen to hear. I said, you're not hearing, you're listening to respond instead of listening to hear. I need you to listen to hear. And it's like, hear what I'm telling you. As a counselor, you're taught to listen to people. And same thing probably as a negotiator. We're taught to listen for patterns. We're taught to listen for, you know, what's the real reason why they're there? Chances are they're there because something has tipped the point. But you got to go back a little bit and figure out what it is that started the whole tipping point.
Yeah. And that was something as a negotiator, you know, you could spend 2 hours, you know, over here talking about something when the real problem and the reason you're there is over here and you haven't even discussed that yet. Mm-hmm. But that was the other part of a negotiator was the trust factor. We never lied to people. You know, we had people that were like, hey, I'll put the gun down and I'll come out or I'll let the hostage go, but you got to promise me I'm not going to jail. Well,
no,
sorry, when you come out, you are going to jail, but then you try to deflect that into something more positive because, you know, we had to develop trust and we never lied to people because there was a very good chance that a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, we were going to be back negotiating with that same person again. And we never wanted them to be able to say, hey, you know, 2 years ago, you said this and that was a lie. Nope, we never lie to you. You may not like what we say, but we never lie to you.
Yeah, and like I said, I was a youth leader for 18 years. And so my kids always knew that, you know what, it may hurt, but I'm gonna tell you the truth. I'm not gonna lie to you. You know, that's just how I roll. I can't lie. I'm one of those people that if I lie, my face grows bright red. So I can't lie. It's just that I know that. So I'm like, I don't even bother trying. I'm like, I'm not gonna lie to you. I can't do it. You're not gonna like what I'm gonna say sometimes, but I'm not gonna lie to you.
Yeah. And that's what being a good policeman was. You know, being a good policeman was talking to people. And you know, and I don't care how good of a liar you are, the more I talk to you, if there's a lie, I'm going to get to that lie. Mm-hmm. I'm going to catch you in something. Well, no, you said it was red and it's blue, or, you know, whatever it was. And that's what I always tell, especially young people, when they ask, you know, what do you think I need to do to be good in law enforcement? I don't get that very often anymore because nobody wants to go into that profession. But when I did, I used to tell them, it's like, put this down, put that, you know, that phone down, put that iPad down and go out on the street and talk to the homeless guy. And then go up to the penthouse and talk to that guy. Because if you can talk to both of those sets of humanity, mm-hmm. you're going to be a pretty good cop. But if you can't, there's nothing you're going to do. All the time learning all these tools on your belt. The biggest tool we all bring to whatever job we have are our brain and our mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you need to look at people as individually, not as whatever prejudice you have or whatever you heard about. Because each person is different. Each person has a story. Each person's story made them that way for a reason. Right. And you need to find out what that is. And so, yeah, I totally agree with all of that. So somebody who wants to find out more about you or your book, which sounds incredible, how can they find you online?
So I have a website, a blog that I put a thought for the day up every day. I put the Monday morning motivational message up every Monday morning, which is usually a video or a story. And that's at motivationalcheck.com. So it's motivational, MOTIVATIONAL. Check, CHECK.com. And that's, you can get to me there. You can get access to the book there, but you can get the book pretty much online, anywhere you can get a book online, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Apple iBooks, any place like that.
But the links are on your website.
They are.
Okay, perfect. So we have just a couple minutes left. Is there anything you'd like to add? Is there one gold nugget, one thing that if you wanted one person, anybody listening to take one thing away, what would it be?
Let me just close with this story. So I've always been a big fan of Westerns growing up. My mom and dad used to let me stay up and watch, you know, Wild Wild West and Gunsmoke when I was young. 1993, the movie Tombstone came out, mm-hmm. and it starred Kurt Russell as a man by the name of Wyatt Earp and Val Kilmer as a man by the name of John Doc Holliday.
I knew Huckleberry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. A great movie. I mean, a lot of people saw it, was very popular. But if you look at Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp were two living, breathing human beings mm-hmm. that actually walked on the face of the earth. They're not just made up characters for the movie. And Wyatt pretty much his whole life had been a lawman. And Doc was called Doc because he was a dentist by trade. But pretty much he was a gunslinger and a card shark. But for some reason, these two men from incredibly divergent backgrounds become very close friends. And at the end of the movie, Doc is dying of tuberculosis at a sanitarium in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 3 hours from my house. And the real Doc Holliday actually died in that sanitarium, is buried in the Glenwood Springs Cemetery. But the two men are talking about what they want out of life. And Doc says, you know what? I was in love with my cousin when I was young, but she joined a convent over the affair. But she's all that I ever want, all that I ever wanted. And he looks at Wyatt and he says, what about you, Wyatt? What do you want? And Wyatt says, I just want to lead a normal life. And Doc looks at him and says, there's no normal, there's just life. And get on with living yours. You know, CJ, you and I know people who, you know, they're sitting back and they're like, well, when this happens, I'll have a normal life. Or when that happens, I'll have a successful life. Or when this happens, I'll have an influential life. Don't wait on life to come to you. Find out what your purpose is on the face of this earth and go out and live that purpose. Because I promise you, if you do that, at the end of your life, you'll have a whole lot more peace and a whole lot more happiness. And I'll leave it at that.
The worst thing you can have is regrets. I wish I did. I wish I could have, et cetera, et cetera. Well, thank you so much, Terry. You have been a treat to talk to. For those who want to learn more about Terry Tucker, you can find him online at motivationalcheck.com, MOTIVATIONALCHECK.com. Again, thank you for coming on today, Terry.
Thank you, CJ. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for your transparency and sharing your story as well. That was a lot. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you guys for listening to The Journey is Real. We talk to real people with real passions who share a real portion of their hearts. I'm CJ Peterson at cjpetersonwrites.com. Until next time.